Hello, thank you all for coming this afternoon. We are a brand new forum here at the Humanities Club, and we're very excited to be joining with Commonwealth. We are very excited to welcome Dr. Saikat Mujumdar to speak today on the Enigma of Arrival, Modern India and Anglophone Literature. He will be speaking this weekend in conjunction with our Humanities West program, which is to be held at the Herbst Theater this Friday and Saturday. It's it's India Rising, Tradition Meets Modernity. We hope you can join us for that program. And please help me to welcome Dr. Mujumdar.
Thanks, Monica, for the introduction. It's a great honor to speak at the Commonwealth Club. And I'd like to thank Humanities West for making this possible. And about this talk, I know, as you've read in the brochure, it's called a survey and kind of an overview. And I like to think of it as something like a survey with an attitude. But, you know, but when I wrote it, I realized it's more attitude than survey. So bear with the idiosyncrasies as I try to give some kind of an objective picture. So this, as Monica mentioned, this is in conjunction with the event India Rising, which actually got me thinking about a slogan, those of you who followed Indian politics, called India Shining. It rhymes with that too, which was coined by the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, to sort of capture, this was in the parliamentary elections of 2004, and the idea was to capture the mood of economic optimism, the IT boom, kind of a post-nuclear political power of India. This slogan, I mean, understandably drew heavy critical fire from not only the opposition party, but from all over. And of course, you know, kind of the simplistic nature of a slogan, of a political catchword, India shining in a country which, with all the development, still has a lot of poverty and problems, is obviously very complicated. But, I mean, that's a different problem altogether. And a lot of people say that this slogan actually was instrumental in helping BJP lose the election because, you know, this was not really warranted. But, you know, without going into the political nature of the reality of the slogan, what interests me is that it seems to me that the semiotic fate of the slogan, that what it conveys to us, has survived a much better destiny. In that it's almost like for all the problems, like we are still recovering from what happened in Mumbai last November, or more recently the financial scandal involving Satyam, which is kind of a blemish on India's economic sort of optimistic mood. But in spite of all that, it almost seems to be that Asian powers like China and India, their rise and their prosperity have something almost of the power of gravity. It's almost hard to resist that. And it probably looks even more empowering and optimistic from the diasporic perspective, where there's been a lot of success, a lot of optimism. And I mean, certainly for me, I've lived in the last 10 years in the three of the areas with the highest concentration of South Asian population, New Jersey, Southern Ontario, and now in the Bay Area. And certainly in the Bay Area, with the Indian diasporic contribution to economic prosperity, makes this kind of a buzzword, India Rising, even more of a reality. I mean, my point is, what the reality conveys is more complicated, but somehow that's the image which seems easy to accept from this perspective. However, my special interest is the relationship between this narrative of economic prosperity and the domain of culture. And this is a very interesting and a thorny question that basically, do the arts prosper in times of economic prosperity? And there's no easy answer to that. Even from the perspective of my discipline, literary studies, there are examples which prove both sides. I mean, for one thing, Elizabethan England, which was the time of greatest economic prosperity and political stability in England, was a wonderful time for flowering of literary genius, Shakespeare, Johnson, metaphysicals. But on the other hand, if you look at the late 19th or the 20th century Britain, which was a time of great political instability, the disintegration of empire, economic uncertainty that also produced the great movement of modernism, post-impressionism, surrealism, which in some ways captured the bleak mood of the times. I mean, even Soviet Union produced some of the greatest artists and writers, even though the state probably tried to sort of suppress them more than encourage them, but still. So there's no easy equation between the domain of the economic and the political on one hand and the cultural on the other. And yet, for this moment, the way Indian culture is being perceived, especially from the diasporic perspective, this relationship seems very important. I say this because it seems to me that perceptions of Indian culture and its celebration arrives here at least partly superstructurally, and I use the concept of superstructure like Marx did, that the economic production forms the base, and the relationships and the equations of the base are reflected in that of the superstructure, which includes culture, philosophy, religion, everything. So in a way, the appreciation and the interest in Indian cultural production is partly contingent on what India represents in the world of global economy and politics, which I think is very different from the way India came here in the Bay Area, say, in the 60s, where it represented a certain lifestyle, certain alternative, certain models of transcendental metaphysical wisdom. So these are different ways in which the cultural moment arrives. And this is actually a very understandable instinct. If you look at any sort of sustained interest in the cultural production of any group or nation in the public sphere, if you examine it closely, there's often a narrative of political power and economic importance. I mean, this is how, in fact, the discipline of anthropology came to be formed. I mean, it was late 19th century, early 20th century. It was very much complicit with the imperialistic project. That is, you know, you need to know a culture to be able to rule it. Same with area studies, which thrived in the U.S. from mid-century onwards, post World War II, and this was also very much connected with the Cold War, and the funding of Soviet and East European programs, which have suffered since the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Now, probably we see a similar shift of importance in the study of languages like Arabic and Chinese. So there's a clear correlation between the political and economic on one hand, and the cultural and the epistemological on the other. And I know I'm sounding very cynical here as a humanist. That I don't have any lack of faith in the innate power of the humanities for the development of the human soul. But it's just that in the public sphere, I do think that the humanities operate in a certain contingent way, depending on the economic and the political power equation of the time. And in some ways, the phrase India Rising captures this mood too. This is a response to the kind of... And what is happening is the cultural superstructure, to a degree, probably needs to replicate not only the interest in these parts of the nation, in these parts of the world, that is very evident at the level of the economic base, but to a degree it also wants to replicate the sense of optimism. There's a great sense of optimism in the realm of the economic and the political. Can the cultural narrative match this optimism? And that's where I think things get complicated, because Indian culture in its entirety is a 5,000-year-old behemoth which cannot be easily fitted into the mode of economic prosperity of a moment. And yet, to a degree, there seems to be a need in the public sphere to capture this vibrancy in the realm of culture. One genre which seems to do a pretty good job is Bollywood cinema, because, it's sartorial elegance, it's lavish dances, it's sort of lush landscapes, and there's a certain sense that this is identical with the sense of energy and the vibrancy which India represents right now. But it's still a popular genre, and there's the quest of some genre with a little more intellectual prestige and weight. And that is where I feel the Indian English literature as a genre kind of steps in. And it's a tremendously rich literature. It's a tremendously rich, very versatile literature. As someone who teaches modern British literature, it's almost impossible to talk about modern British literature in the second half, especially of the 20th century till today, without also talking of the literature of the Commonwealth, which has become an extension of British literature, a kind of extension which really overpowers what was once the center. Because, you know, if you look at the Booker Prize winners in the last 20 years, most of them are from India, Africa, Caribbean, much more than white native British winners. So it's a tremendously rich literature, and yet what troubles me a little bit about the narrative about this literature is that it has come to embody a certain kind of national pride. It has come to reflect the momentum of economic optimism, which it's almost like they have a symbiotic relationship with each other, that this new economic power has found a proper cultural equivalent. And this equivalence between the artistic and the economic needs to be troubled, because the arts are never simply about optimism, development. It's also about failure. It's also about the outsider. It's also about the bohemian. And almost like these important specs are in the danger of being lost. And there's almost an interesting 10-year lag if Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children, which was published in 1981, is seen as the age which is seen as ushering the period of this kind of optimism in Indian English literature, especially the novel. It's 1991, 10 years after that, that Manmohan Singh, who's now the Prime Minister, sort of opened up the country's economy to liberalization. And it's almost like now there's this kind of equivalence between the two domains, and which is why I made this kind of tongue-in-cheek analogy between the software, sort of state-of-the-art software, and the award-winning novel, because they seem to be India's best imports right now. And it's almost like the economic success is never complete without an appropriate cultural narrative, and now they seem to have found each other. This connects to the larger question of how literature is always embedded into sort of broader social, political, and economic questions. And all literature is embedded. It's not just Indian English literature or sort of global literatures, but all literature is embedded to various degrees. However, I do think that literature which originated at least as a kind of a hybrid mode, a literature written in which was once a colonial language, these questions are raised in a very self-conscious way, in a way they may not be raised in metropolitan literature written by a white writer. And in the field of Indian English literature, these questions have taken many forms historically. One is, the initial questions was, is it really possible? Is Indian literature possible in English? Is English an Indian language at all? And there was a great deal of skepticism earlier on, mid-century after decolonization, that it's not possible. And critics like Buddhadeb Bose, and even Western critics and writers like Yeats and Steven Spender said that, you cannot do it. You cannot create literature in a language which you didn't learn in childhood, which again is a very controversial term. For a large number of Indians, English is the native language, and there are those for whom. So it's a kind of a blanket statement. But the point is, those debates are now long over. Indians and people of Indian origin have convincingly proved that they can create very high quality literature in English, not necessarily the same as English literature, but in some way extending that literature, playing with the language, modifying it, almost kind of altering the great club of English literature in a kind of a way to take it to a new direction. And even within India, the domestic readership of English literature is now huge. All the multinational publishing houses like Penguin, Random House, HarperCollins, they've all opened up shop in India, and there's a huge interest in popular writing also. And in some ways, the health of a culture is probably most clearly evident from the health of popular culture. And I remember even in the 90s in college, for a light reading, we would turn to John Grisham or Stephen King. And now young people in India are much more, they read those authors still, but they're much more likely to turn to a Chetan Bhagat or one of the sort of any of them in endless numbers of popular fiction writers. And that shows and that says a lot about how English has become not only a popular language, but an everyday literary language. It's kind of an oxymoronic expression because the everyday is that which is not the literary. But in this case, there's a certain, there's been a diminution of the self-consciousness of English. It's people don't use English in a self-conscious way anymore. It's just, it's kind of become a cultural equivalent of the expanding middle class. That now, again, the economic expansion of the country makes possible a certain middle class of a certain size, an urban middle class, also going beyond the usual metropolitan centers, even the smaller towns, who are now, who read English in a very unselfconscious way and modify the language, sort of pepper it with Hindi and local vernaculars to create a very interesting hybrid language. And this itself is not a new phenomenon because Indian English and the Oxford Learner's Dictionary, I remember even 10 years ago, had a supplement on Indian English. And the first entry was ABCD, and it had all kinds of entries. And, you know, even writers like Salman Rushdie, they have what people call chutneyfied the language. There's Raja Rao, who used the language with a cadence of Sanskrit. But it seems to me that there was a certain literary self-consciousness about these efforts. They really ended up dirtying the purity of Queen's English, which was their purpose. They really ended up modifying the language in significant ways. But at the same time, it hadn't entered popular demotic consciousness the way it is happening right now. And this to me certainly speaks to a certain kind of economic prosperity, which is very urban in nature, and this is a kind of indicates the future patterns of consumption of not only English language print but digital media and electronic products in the country, and this is interesting because the self-consciousness about the status of English as a literary language has a long history in India, which is completely understandable. Domestically, it battled with accusations of elitism, deracination, a certain kind of colonial hangover. You keep writing in the language of the colonizer long after the colonizer is gone. And even abroad, it had to, especially in the Western market, it had to struggle with all kinds of perceptions of exoticism, or sometimes more specifically had to fulfill a certain anthropological function that, oh, I have the time to read one novel about India, you know, so pack everything in there, you know, give me the grand narrative. I have the time to read one novel about Nigeria. So novels had to kind of struggle against this burden of fulfilling an anthropological need, which maybe a novel, a local novel written in California wouldn't have to, even if they often have done so, but it's not something that is part of their expectation. And this, I argue, has taken a toll on the aesthetic function of the novel. Even if many novels have, I mean, my knowledge of many countries in the world comes from novels and plays and poems, and this is a wonderful thing. And yet, once a genre gets kind of tied down by this burden, as has happened often with the Indian English novel, it is not exactly a salutary thing for the aesthetic mission of that art form. And this is what interests me, along with how you know, this mode of celebration in the public sphere gets wedded to an art form which is really a much more private and much more idiosyncratic thing than linear economic development. But just to give some examples of how Indian writers in English traditionally grapple with these anxieties, I just name a few poets. There were these 19th century Bengal-based poets. I mean, Indian writing in English goes back to the 19th century, if not before, even though it really doesn't attain global momentum till the 20th century. But we had the poets like Michael Madhusudan Dutt, Henry D'Orozio, Toru Dutt, and they were grappling with various kinds of anxiety. For instance, again, there was the obvious anxiety of patriotism versus Anglophilia. a time when anti-colonial movement is in full swing, what does it mean to write poetry in English? Is it a colonial gesture? Somewhat more complicatedly, there was the question of what is their poetic imaginary made up of? It's very difficult for, and this is true not only of poets from India, but poets from many parts of the global south, that to grow up, say, for instance, in a tropical landscape, and yet have your education entirely made up of sort of colonial literature. So the result is what I call the daffodil syndrome. You start, it's much easier for you to write poems about daffodil in the snow and call palm trees and mango as exotic. The Caribbean writer Jamaica Kincaid has a wonderful essay about it, that she grew up writing about her own landscape as exotic, which is the most mystifying thing, because, but she was clearly conditioned by the literary perspective from England, from the metropolis, which described Caribbean landscape as exotic. But so much so that she ended up thinking of everything she saw around herself as exotic. And these were some of the problems plaguing the poets, Indian English poets in the 19th century. Their poems were full of the imagery taken from Milton and the Romantics. And only later they realized that they can turn the English language into the service of the sort of the immediate sensual realities which they see around themselves and not weaned from a certain romantic tradition of English literature. And they grappled with these questions in many different forms. It was a question of political ethics as well. Michael Madhusudan, one of the most famous poets of the time, in the end gave up writing in English altogether, and he started writing in Bengali, which was his native language, and he became the greatest epic poet of the language. So these debates continued in poetry. The novel, however, really doesn't take off till around the 1930s, and the three most important figures here are R.K. Narayan, Raja Rao, and Mulk Raj Anand. I imagine many of you have heard and read some of these three writers. And, you know, of these three, Anand, probably is the most ideologically, his ideology is the easiest to pin down. He hobnobbed with the Bloomsbury group of modernists, with Wolfe and Foster in the 1930s England. And he was also very influenced by the global climate of Marxism. So many of his novels delineate a certain socialist ethics, especially his most famous novel, which is Coolie. And Raja Rao, on the other hand, I mean, his first novel, Kanthapura, also shows the influence of Gandhian socialism, but he's a little more complicated because probably the most significant influence in his writing is a certain Hindu metaphysical wisdom, which really comes out in his most famous novel, The Serpent and the Rope, which the title itself is a play on the Hindu idea of illusion or Maya, that whether you are actually getting to see the serpent or the rope, it's a matter of optical illusion. And but probably the most interesting figure of these three, the three are considered the founding fathers of the Indian English novel, Rao, Narayan, and Anand. And Narayan is probably the most interesting figure because he's the hardest to pin down. His politics, his morality is the hardest to specify. What's also interesting is Narayan is also the most homegrown. He's the one writer who never lived abroad, who was not educated abroad. His relationship with English was completely indigenous. I mean, there's, of course, the matter of his famous friendship with Graham Greene, the British novelist who helped him gain entry into the Western publishing world. But Narayan is very, very interesting because his most famous novel, Guide, which was turned into a very well-known film starring Raj Kapoor and Nargis. I'm sorry, this is Devanand and Nargis. And the protagonist of that novel, Raju, is an amazing figure. He's a total loser. He's a complete failure. He's irresponsible. His morality is very ambivalent, and this is exactly the kind of ambivalence which, you know, the Indian poet and writer Amit Chaudhary has sort of talks about, that this moral irresponsibility is now missing from Indian English literature in its mood of celebration, that the Indian English novelist has become like a, what is the son-in-law in the romance of the Indian family. He's very bankable, successful, preferably settled abroad. And it's kind of this, and this, and this, these are the kind of outsiders, the kind of marginal figures which we don't find anymore in the novel. And more importantly, the celebratory discourse around it. So, so the founding trinity of the Indian English novel continued to live for a long time. They all lived into their 90s and together gave rise to the myth that the easiest way to longevity is to write in English, because Indian English writers never die. I mean, they lived in the 90s. Nirodh C. Chaudhary lived over 100. And there was a lot of other prose written which captured the spirit of mid-century Nehruvian India. And some of these writers are Bhavani Bhattacharya, Manohar Malgaonkar, Kamala Markandeo, Anita Desai, and Ruth Jabwala. But probably the most interesting ideological and aesthetic debates of the time were actually being carried out in the realm of poetry. And especially the very sensitive question as to whether English is a suitable language for poetry in English, which in some ways was seen as a even more personal and intimate genre of self-expression. And 1958 is a crucial date here, where the Punjab-born poet Pilal set up Writer's Workshop, which was many things in one. It was kind of a group of Indian poets and later some prose writers who wrote in English, who rallied around their art and issued manifestos and sort of expressed their belief in this new genre. It was also a literary press which produced works of Indian literature in English. It was the first press of its kind to produce, though it also published some Westerners who wrote on India. In limited, this beautifully produced, handcrafted editions. They were very much in the middle of this debate about whether English is a viable language for literature in India. And they were very staunch in their beliefs. The mood of the country, the freshly decolonized country, was certainly seemed to be against. And there was a lot of suspicion, not only of Indian English writers, but the success and the financial rewards they were getting in the West. So all of this was seen with a lot of suspicion in a kind of the socialist, post-colonial mood of the country. But the Writers' Workshop poets really held on to their belief with a lot of courage and belief, even before this genre kind of attained the commercial success of today. And they went on to say that not only can poetry in English be Indian poetry can be written in English, but it can only be written in English, because all other local languages, you can write Gujarati poetry or Bengali poetry or Assamese poetry, but English is the only language where you can actually write Indian poetry, which is again a very debatable claim. There was a similar debate played out in the Nigerian context between Ngugi Wa Thiong'o and Chinua Achebe, and Ngugi was very much in favor of literature created in the vernaculars. He eventually, even though having a very successful career writing in English, he gave up and started writing in his native Gikyu. And Achebe actually made a similar kind of a claim that English is the pan-Nigerian language. The other languages can be tribal. And this is a very controversial claim, and I mean, we can't do justice to this claim in this limited space. But the point was, historically speaking, this was an important claim being made by the Writers' Workshop poets. And they pioneered, they blazed the trail for Indian writing in English, not necessarily in a kind of a commercial space, but in a space of debate and kind of exchange. And they also published published for the first time many of the poets and writers who would go on to achieve great national and global fame, like Nissim Ezekiel, Dom Morris, Shashi Deshpande, K. Ramanujam, and Vikram Seth. And this debate is obviously now long over. It's almost like 1981 was a watershed year, where the publication of Midnight's Children, I mean, which is kind of signified the end of Nehruvian India, and which is interesting because in many ways Midnight's Children is a very Nehruvian novel. I mean, it's very sort of irreverential, very kind of playful on surface, but the narrative it portrays is a kind of a very much a Nehruvian dream of a socialist, secular sort of republic. And the time period of its publication not only ushered an end of this kind of socialist period, but also you know, opened up what I now see as this age of optimism and confidence and this great commercial success of Indian literature. This was the beginning. And in doing so, it completely brushed aside any skepticism about whether English can be a viable language for Indian literature. And so much so that it almost made it seem impossible that this skepticism could ever exist. You know, can you even doubt that? And 25 years, more than 25 years have passed since then, but in a sense, Indian English literature still seems to inhabit that post-Midnight's Children moment. I mean, there have been some modifications of the model of literary writing that this novel brought about. For instance, one genre that became very dominant after Midnight's Children was that of the national allegory, which became the reigning paradigm of the Indian English novel, which, you know, a lot of writers, especially women writers like Arundhati Roy and Kiran Desai, have really troubled that by bringing the novel back to the private sphere, pulling it away from the national public domain. But even so, even with these modifications, in terms of what the Indian English novel now signifies to the Western market, especially in the sense it's a commodity for significant cultural consumption, it still owes its prime legacy to Salman Rushdie, especially to the 1981 novel. I mean, for one thing, poetry, which was a very crucial space for debate and exchange in mid-century, has almost completely brushed out of the picture, and it doesn't seem to be a candidate for cultural ambassadorship the way it was earlier. I mean, of course, poetry always tends to take a back seat next to the novel anywhere, but in this case, because in some ways the novel is the genre which probably travels the best, theater tends to be a very locally rooted genre. It doesn't do well on foreign soil. I mean, there are exceptions once they enter the canon, but it has a certain activist strain in it, which is really organically connected to the local community. Poetry is very nuanced, and novels seem to be the best vehicle of a certain sociological knowledge, a certain historical knowledge, which seems to be the expectation when we read about literature from other cultures. What knowledge can it give us? And the kind of knowledge poetry offers is far more personal, far more idiosyncratic, far more nuanced. Novels can also offer that kind of knowledge, but they can also offer a more straight-up sociological knowledge. And those are probably reasons why this, certainly the Indian English novel has traveled much better than the other genres, which is really a shame, because great poetry is still being written in English. And for another interesting trend Rushdie's novel set was that it set up a way of using the novel as a kind of a larger story of the nation. That is, it was no matter what the story is, the real story is always about colonialism, decolonization, and post-colonial identity formation. It's really explained very well by the American theorist Frederick Jameson, who wrote an essay, and his very controversial claim was that any novel from the Third World, doesn't matter what its subject, even if it's telling the story of a marriage or a personal relation, it's the real story is always the story of the nation, and it's an allegory. Even if it's a personal relation, the personal really stands as an allegory for the public, that because the public domain is so embattled in these countries, and it's so sort of steeped in this battle with global capitalism and colonial powers, that no story is free of this. And this, again, is a very highly debatable claim, but it does have a degree of relevance to the kind of novel Midnight's Children pioneered. I mean, think of the novel where Salim Sinai is born at the stroke of midnight on 15th August 1947. So he's allegorically the nation. He's a child, but he is also the nation. And in fact, his story is really not his story. It is a story of India. And this becomes a popular model, which you see not only in India, you see that in Colombia, in Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, you see that in Nigeria, Benno Kris, the Famish Road. So for a lot of so-called third world narratives, the story of the private life always becomes kind of an allegory for the public life, which is very interesting and also very problematic, because the private sphere has its own story. The domestic sphere, often the women's stories, really get kind of pushed out of this anxiety to tell the big story of the nation, the grand story. And it also comes out of a certain political anxiety of the newly decolonized nation of the nation, that we must get our stories heard, which is a very understandable political need. But again, to enact that need in the domain of the aesthetic, I think takes a toll on the aesthetic mission of this writing. So, and there are many novels like this. One is, some of the best known is Shashi Tharoor's The Great Indian Novel, which really kind of combines the story of the ancient Indian epic, the Mahabharata, with the story of the Indian freedom struggle. And then there's Mukul Kesavan's Looking Through Glass. And, you know, there were many, and there were a number of lesser known novels of this model. There were other writers who deviated from this model. Probably the best known of them is Vikram Seth, who has never stuck to any one genre. He's written novels, novel in verse, poetry, opera, written probably the longest novel in the English language, A Suitable Boy, 1,349 pages it stands. And but either way, there's a great deal of excitement about this genre, and that is not only because of the innovativeness of the genre and the very high quality of these novels, but they seem to deliver on the post-colonial novel promise of telling the story of the nation, of offering a certain comprehensive and historical knowledge about the nation in question. And this is what I see as taking a toll on the aesthetic principle and mission of the novel. And one can see why a medium like this, why a model of narration like this gets very easily wedded to the trope of celebration in the national economic public sphere, because they almost seem to made for one another. It's almost a literature of the public sphere, literature of the public domain. And it has gone hand in hand with the great deal of recognition, financial success, which this genre has very rightfully received. And it almost seems to me that at this point, a Marxist historian's dream has come true, that the narrative of the economic base has found its perfect counterpart in the narrative of the cultural superstructure, that software and novel, they really kind of reinforce each other perfectly. And this is this, you know, easy marriage between rising sort of post-nuclear Indian ambition and economic prominence on the other, and the art form, which does make me a little uneasy. But I'm going to conclude my talk with two very new books, which it seemed to me promise a new direction from this. Maybe this form is still changing, and there are future directions possible. And both these books, both these works actually reveal not only the new economic prosperity, but a very dark underbelly of that economic prosperity, a kind of a brutal, kind of a messy underbelly. And that really interests me. One is the novel which won the Booker Prize last year. This is Arvind Dadiga's The White Tiger, which is a very interesting novel. It's a series of letters written by this semi-literate servant to the Chinese premier Wen Jiabao. And it's a very brutal tale of upward mobility. In fact, so brutal, and it is really placed into the India's hub of frenetic economic prosperity, Bangalore. And what shocks us is how easily this brutality actually fits into this center of software, you know, progress and development. And this kind of gives us pause. And there's also a very strong, what you might call a proletarian ethic driving this novel, because the narrator protagonist of this novel, who's writing these letters to the Chinese premier, his name is Balram Halwai. He hails from clearly what is the darkest and the most peripheral part of the country's poverty-stricken areas, and that is rural Bihar. In fact, throughout the novel, he calls that patch of his life, the darkness. I hail from the darkness. And it's a darkness made up not only of poverty, starvation, but oppression by landlords. It's a terrible. And from there, it's a narrative of upward mobility. It moves into Delhi, where he's a chauffeur to a rich man. And then he ends up murdering his employer, and then transplants his persona and becomes a new person and goes to Bangalore and participates in Bangalore software prosperity. So it's very interesting how it moves from the absolute backwater of the most of the darkest patch of India's economic and political horizon to its center, Bangalore. And it does so. It's also a novel of upward mobility, but it's an upward mobility which is very brutal. Which is very messy, which is full of murder and darkness. And this is also a novel for the moment, but it's in some ways it troubles that kind of easy optimism, that this is an optimism which is gained at great cost. The other novel is Vikas Sarup's very well-known novel Q&A, which, as you probably know, has been turned into the movie Slumdog Millionaire. This is also a similar narrative of upward mobility, where a boy from the slums ends up reaching a point where he gets ₹1 billion, and the boy, he's called Ram Mohammad Thomas in the book. In the movie, he's called Jamal, and he wins the jackpot. So it's a different kind of a mobility. But what's interesting is his life, if you've seen the movie, if you haven't read the book, his life, he has this, his relationship to knowledge and history is very interesting. He spends his life gathering accidental bits of knowledge. I mean, it's almost like he lives his life like a game of trivia. I mean, it's a very kind of sad and dangerous life, so it's kind of trivializing to call it a game of trivia. But the reality is that the oddest bits of knowledge sticks to his mind. I mean, there's one example which is not in the movie, it's in the book, is that when he reads, I forget if he reads or sees it on TV somewhere, when Gandhi was shot, he uttered, his last words were, "Hi, Ram." And the thing which strikes Thomas is that, oh, that's my name. You know, so it's not the tremendous political importance and the historical weight of the moment of Gandhi dying that strikes him, but the fact that he utters his name. I mean, this is the way this guy's mind works. This is, you know, his mind is kind of this glue, which it's a kind of his very sticky piece of glue, which kind of gathers all these idiosyncratic bits of knowledge. And so you can easily imagine if he faced the question, you know, what were Gandhi's last words before he died, A, B, C, you'd have no trouble saying that. And I mean, he doesn't get the question, but you get the picture. It's easy for him to answer that. So this story of this boy getting this ₹1 billion not only tells us about his nature and his life, but also the very nature of the show, and the nature of the show as, you know, as it works out in a sort of in a country like India, where there are vast and disparate segments of life and very strange and idiosyncratic kind of knowledges they spawn. And of course, it takes a tremendous stroke of luck for Thomas or Jamal for these knowledges to come together with the questions he gets in the quiz show. And that's what he claims repeatedly, that the secret of my success is luck, when the police torture him, and he keeps saying, and the problem is that he has won the jackpot too early. The show hasn't run long enough for the sponsors to actually rake in the revenues through ads, and it's a matter of major inconvenience that they can't let him win it. So the idea is to get a confession, and he keeps saying it's luck, and he's being completely honest. It's really a kind of a luck combined with this very strange and idiosyncratic way of gathering knowledge. I mean, he's the guy who doesn't know the capital of France, Italy, thinks the capital of US is New York, can't blame him, but knows the capital of Papua New Guinea. I mean, that's because that's exactly how he, there's no logic. It's not the kind of knowledge which belongs to the intellectual or the academic. It's a very different kind of a knowledge. And it's not surprising that the prize for this knowledge is actually not the kind of epistemological confidence which comes out of a certain command over history or a domain of knowledge, but brute cash. You know, and that's the cash which rightfully belongs to him, he gives up, and again, this is not in the movie itself, but in the book, that he gives up money he could have stolen or the money he earned by labor. But this is the kind of money which he actually deserves, because this is the kind of life he has led. This is the kind of mind he has. And then there is luck. So what is interesting about these two texts in light of this relationship between the economic narrative and the cultural narrative is that they're both, for one thing, upward mobility stories. They're both about people rising sort of from the bottom to get a piece of the pie. And interestingly, they're both narrated by very marginal people. I mean, for want of a better word, by the underclass. And White Tiger, for instance, if you read it, it really even replicates at the level of its language and discourse, the semi-literate sensibility of the narrator. It almost jars your reading experience. It's kind of an anti-aesthetic experience because it's not supposed to have finesse and polish, because it's at a realistic sense, it's supposed to have this kind of odd, jarring moments. And at the same time, both these novels really kind of show, as I was talking earlier, the power of popular fiction, and the power of not just the popular, even pulp fiction. I mean, to use the dreaded word, it's really pulp fiction, and they've sold very widely in India. And now, with the Booker and Oscar sort of labels, they promise to sell even more. And especially Q&A really has no literary pretensions at all. It's very plainly written. I think the movie is actually much better made than the novel, though there is more in the book. So if you like the movie, I'd recommend you read the book as well. And but what is very intriguing is they are both truly literatures of economic prosperity, which was the context of my talk, that they are in that sense very timely, very different kinds of economic prosperity, not the kind of economic prosperity which is a kind of a socially acceptable model of mobility. One through murder and crime, and the other through a game show. But and this is the kind of prosperity where the kind of equivalence between culture and economics, which I see, is enacted, but enacted with a deep violence. There's almost a violence in this equation which gives us pause. And not just that, it really pushes us beyond the kind of equivalence which is easily imaginable in the lives of a national middle class, which is what has dominated the genre of the Indian English novel or Indian English literature for the longest time. So I think these are promising new leads, and we should wait and see as to what the future brings. Thank you.
Please, if you have a chance, you should check out Dr. Majumdar's book, Silverfish, which is available on Amazon. And now we'll open the floor up to questions, if anyone has any questions for Dr. Majumdar. All right, well, thank you again.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure speaking here.
I have a question.
Sure.
You're using the word mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right? What do you use when the majority of masses of India don't have mobility?
Yeah, it's not a mobility which is available to the masses, but yet the idea of social mobility is extremely important, probably in any society, and it remains, you know, at least a dream, if not a praxis. I mean, so much of professional lives are about mobility. Especially the new economic prosperity has given mobility to many, to whom I think I see India as slowly transforming from a kind of almost a semi-feudal society where to a kind of, as capitalism gains strength, mobility becomes reality for many more people. Even 15 years back, you couldn't buy a house in India without putting the whole money down as a down payment. Now there's financing possible, so that if you have a good job, you can. So you see things like ownership of cars and houses have become relevant to the much wider reach of people. So there is certainly a certain kind of mobility. But of course, it's a very troubled idea. You're absolutely right that it remains out of the reach for the vast majority of people, and their mobility is almost kind of an ironical dream. But it is not to say that India has now a middle class of a 250,000 people, which is almost the size of the entire population of the U.S., which explains the new markets and all of that over there. So I think it's there certainly as a dream, if not as a reality for the entire population. Absolutely, 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 definitely. Yeah. No, no, absolutely. You're right about that. Yes. That's a really good question. Well, it started in India, as you know, in Pataliputra, which is now in Bihar. My sense is it is really, I mean, there was the period, historically speaking, Buddhism, where it was really Hinduized. It kind of became almost part of the Hindu pantheon. And at times, it becomes hard to distinguish. Buddha is actually considered one of the 10 avatars of Vishnu, which is a very interesting example of how Hinduism and Buddhism has actually intermingled to the point where they're almost hard to distinguish from one another. Right now, well, for one thing, there's a lot of awareness among the left circles about the situation with Tibet and the Dalai Lama. So there is activism on that front. But other than that, it seems to be a fringe religion. I may be wrong about that, but my sense is certainly it's not something you see practiced outside certain geographical locations in India. Well, I'm probably a pessimist, that's why I am. There's a long tradition in literature of glorifying failure and sadness. Maybe I belong there, but it seems more interesting than success anyway when it comes to aesthetic representation. But the idea was, I was really caught by the idea of how an experience of two people from totally different time zones. One is this widow living in 19th century India, 19th century Bengal, and the other is this sort of elderly man, a lower middle class man, sort of trapped in the bureaucracy and a kind of a communist government and the corruption in the system, how their experiences can speak to each other. They have nothing in common. They have nothing in common in age, gender, historical period, except the very experience of immobility. And except the whole experience of being on the fringes of society, where they have a great deal of trouble having their voices heard, and this is how one of them stumble across the narrative of the other, and it echoes with him a sense of a resonance that it's almost that a sense of an empathy grows, and the novel is really about the story of this empathy, how and I guess in some ways I also wanted to. Portray the immobility, as you put it so well, in the middle of this narrative of mobility, which probably reaches us more widely here. And as the question you rightly brought out, is the immobile population in the same way? I mean, we talk of immigration as something which is very empowering, but for the vast majority of the world's population, immigration is not a possibility, or when it's a possibility, it's a very sad and devastating thing coming out of partition or famine or some natural disaster. So in some ways, it's not just my political conscience which made me write this. I mean, you don't write novels out of political consciousness. You write novels out of aesthetic idea. But there's a certain aesthetic power in this experience which really drew me. And that's what I try to capture. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Hmm.
their role models, all that's changed. Mm-hmm. There's an optimism among them that supports well.
That's interesting. And do you have any evidence of whether this hope has been justified or sort of been borne out in future generations or
my
subsequent? Yes, absolutely. Yep. That's very interesting. I mean, mobility is it's such an important force, whether as an idea or as a reality, in a country where social and economic differences are so staggering. It's really hard to imagine in a place like the U.S., which is really not marked by that. I mean, there are differences here too, but the differences are nothing as like in a country like India, where it's a very important dream in various forms. And it's interesting how these two books, which I talked about, really cling on desperately to that idea of mobility and the idea of, you know, getting a piece of the pie by hook or crook, literally. And this desperation is very, very, very interesting. Yes. Absolutely. Like television was probably 20 years back, but now many times over. You're absolutely right. Yes. I'm sure. Yes. Absolutely. Bangalore is a fascinating example. I actually haven't been there, but almost everyone I know who comes from Bangalore has very mixed feelings about the city's development. And I have a colleague at Stanford who comes from Bangalore. She teaches in the drama department, and she recently produced a version of Chekhov's play Cherry Orchard, but she set it in Bangalore. And those of you who know Cherry Orchard know that this, you know, very interesting transformation from kind of a czarist feudal Russia to a capitalist Russia, and all the pains and sort of joys associated with it. I mean, where the sale of this beautiful piece of property, Cherry Orchard, to start something like a multi-story apartment building or something of that sort in early 20th century Russia. And this is so appropriate to what's happening in Bangalore right now. People who have memories of Bangalore as a city of gardens. But this is the, I feel this is like the double-edged sort of development. In a sense, it is a departure from an older world of beauty. But at the same time, this was an older world of beauty which was available to a very limited feudal class. So democratically and politically, you're happier, but aesthetically, there's a loss. So in the end, it's very hard to balance. This is exactly the message in Chekhov's play, and I haven't seen Jisha's production set in Bangalore, but I imagine it's a very similar story, that you don't have that kind of beauty, but was the beauty ever available to a wider range of population? So the mourning that is now hear is of a population which had the kind of privilege once in the past. But you're right about the point about definitely. I mean, you see the same thing with alumni donations in universities. That's another thing which is, I mean, here the culture of donation to your alma mater is amazing, and that's something that's completely missing. I mean, I wonder if it has to do with a nation reaching a certain state of capitalism where, you know, I mean, it's kind of ironical that a lot of NGO work, a lot of funding in the arts, a lot of humanistic work becomes possible in a certain moment of capitalist prosperity, even though your socialist conscience might speak against it. And I wonder if that has something to do with it, or it is more deeply connected to the Indian sensibility of helping people in a different way, along familial, along kinship lines, not along these kind of public sphere lines, which is sort of disconnected from the traditional networks, on lines of which I think they can be extremely helpful, as you say. So yeah, that's very interesting. Anything else? Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you all. Thanks for coming.